Good morning.
Good to see you all. Can you hear me back there? Excellent. Feels good. I hope you're all being careful as you walk like a penguin. I don't love having a lot of ice on the sidewalk, but it does promote mindfulness. Normally, we don't see the penalty of non-mindfulness so immediately as we do when nature puts us down on the ground. So anyway, I'm going to talk today about the Kalama Sutta. Sometimes we might say Kalama Sutra. Sutra is the later word and Sutta is the earlier pronunciation. And so this is a really early Buddhist text from the Pali Canon. So the Pali Canon is kind of the earliest layer of Buddhist texts and generally considered the most historically accurate representation of what early Buddhism was. But it often says the Buddha said this, and then Shariputra said that, and then Kisa Gotami said that. And the thing is, we don't really know what those people said, because it was quite a while ago. And frankly, a lot of us probably can't even remember what our spouses said 10 minutes before. So let's just be honest about how this works. Anyway, I'm going to just make my way through this piece of literature. And, you know, I like to read directly from source texts. Sometimes people go, oh, the literature, it's hard to understand, and the style is kind of stilted. Because I don't know how much 2,500-year-old literature you read, but most of it seems a little bit strange to modern ears. But if we are going to respectfully carry forward the tradition of Buddhism in this country, I think it is really important that we honor it through textual study, through other means as well. But one, just actually going to the source texts and not just being like, wow, we've got it all figured out. We'll keep figuring it out and then keep not knowing. So anyway, here we go. Thus have I heard. On one occasion, the Blessed One, a.k.a. the Buddha, was wandering on tour together with a large community of monks when he arrived at a town of the Kalamas called Keshaputta. Now the Kalamas of Keshaputta heard, it is said that the ascetic Gotama, that is the Buddha, the Shakyan son who went forth from a Shakyan family, has arrived in Keshaputta. Now, a good report about that master Gotama has been circulating thus. That blessed one is an arhat, perfectly enlightened, accomplished in true knowledge and conduct, having realized with his own direct knowledge this world with its devas, Mara and Brahma, this population with its ascetics and Brahmins, with its devas and humans, he makes it known to other. He teaches a dharma that is good in the beginning, good in the middle, and good in the end, with the right meaning and expression. He reveals a spiritual life that is perfectly complete and purified. So it is good for us to see such arhats. So the Buddha's wandering around the Indian countryside with a community of people, sangha, of monks, and he comes into this neighborhood where he has not been before, where a group of people called the Kalamas live. And they're like, oh, we've heard about this person. And, you know, if you could follow, it sounds like the report that's going around is pretty good. It's pretty darn good. A little passage in here that may or may not strike you, as it says here, having realized with his own direct knowledge this world with its devas, Mara and Brahma, this population with ascetics and Brahmins. So devas, in case you don't know, are gods. Mara is kind of like the devil, the promulgator of evil. And Brahma remains one of the central gods of Hinduism. So Brahma's like a universal god, way over all these little devas who are chattering around. I don't have a lot of direct experience personally with devas, Mara and Brahma, that I know of. Of course, I may have a lot and just be ignorant. That's entirely possible. But my guess is most people in this room are not thinking that we live in a world where devas come and hang out with us, or Mara and Brahma are doing a lot of stuff. I'm not sure. Maybe you do. But for what I like to think about when I look at this personally is people have had a lot of different ways of looking at the world and a lot of different ways about thinking what the basic structure of the world is and who is living in the world. In fact, it's already true. We could go somewhere like probably a half mile from here, and there are going to be people who have a very specific idea about a particular kind of God, and there may be some people in this room who have such an idea, and then people who don't. And then, we may also have a lot of very particular ideas about how the world should be or what the world's made of, that it's made of matter and matter generates mind or whatever. Everyone has a lot of assumptions about this. The thing is, they're all different. And although we may be very certain that we've got it right, in a few hundred years or a few thousand years, the way we view the world will almost surely appear strange and benighted to someone else, as it already does. So, I don't know. I'm happy to meet any devas who show up. And if any don't, that's okay with me too. But when looking at texts like this, one of the main things I want to maintain is openness and humility towards the vastness of what human understanding can be. Then the Kalamas of Keshaputta approached the Blessed One. So they went and found him. Some paid homage to him and sat down to one side. Some exchanged greetings with him, and after their greetings and cordial talk, sat down on one side. Some saluted him reverentially and sat down to one side, and some remained silent and sat down to one side. So, by the way, if you read Pali Canon text, you'll read that exact same set of sentences hundreds of times, because this is a textual tradition that's made of formulas for memorization. So whenever someone goes to meet somebody, if they're pretty polite about it, that's how it's described. If they're not polite, it may say something else. But we see these little kind of chunks of language, just like in the Odyssey where Homer continuously refers to the wine dark sea. Like, couldn't you come up with another image? Well, it'd be hard to remember 400, so we'll stick with one. The wine dark sea. So, having greeted the Buddha, then the Kalama said to the Blessed One, "Venerable Sir, some ascetics and Brahmins who come to Keshaputta explain and elucidate their own doctrines, but disparage, debunk, revile, and vilify the doctrines of others." We know nothing about this in this day and age, I'm sure. "But then some other ascetics and Brahmins come to Keshaputta, and they too explain and elucidate their own doctrines, but disparage, debunk, revile, and vilify the doctrines of others. For us, Venerable Sir, there is perplexity and doubt as to which of these good ascetics speak the truth and which speak falsehood." So sometimes we like to think, oh yeah, in northern India they believed in this, they believed in devas and Brahmins and karma, and actually belief was very diverse in the time of the Buddha, just in the little region of India where he lived. There were people going around saying, it doesn't matter what you do. They were total nihilists. You can do anything and it doesn't matter. Other people were like, if you do something bad, you will be punished forever. And other people were explaining that like nothing existed. Other people were saying everything is made out of your soul. So there are all these really vast array of worldviews, kind of like our time now. And these Kalamas are like, these people come through and they go, oh, we're going to teach you something spiritual. And then they all say different stuff. And not only do they say different stuff, but they say the other people are like, well, they debunk, revile, and vilify the others. Ah, yes. The human condition. The Buddha said, that's not what he said. I don't think. I don't know how you'd write that down. Mm-hmm. Venerable sir, some ascetics and Brahmins who come to Keshaputta... I skipped ahead here. It is fitting for you to be perplexed, O Kalamas, said the Buddha. It is fitting for you to be in doubt. Doubt has arisen you about a perplexing matter. Come, Kalamas, do not go by oral tradition, by lineage of teaching, by hearsay, by a collection of texts, by logic, by inferential reasoning, by reasoned cogitation, by the acceptance of a view after pondering it, by the seeming competence of a speaker, or because you think, this ascetic is our teacher. But when you know for yourselves, these things are unwholesome, these things are blamable, these things are censured by the wise, these things, if practiced, lead to harm and suffering, then you should abandon them. So this is really the crux of the sutra. So the modes of belief that Buddha says don't go on are pretty comprehensive. We'll see that they're not the only way he talks about how you should determine whether something is true. But it's pretty astonishing, right? He's just like, don't trust me and don't trust anyone else to tell you. And don't think you can just figure it out by thinking about it all the time. So the first thing he does here is he affirms how they feel. So yeah, I could see why you'd be perplexed and doubtful, right? If you meet people and they bring you something difficult, the first thing you should do is affirm. Meet them where they are. You don't have to explain to them how things should be or how they should view it. Start, that makes sense. Doubt and perplexity. That's very reasonable. And then he immediately steps into empowerment and trust of the people he's talking to. He says, it's not going to be for me to explain. You can trust yourself. You can trust yourself. And the kind of trust he's talking about, as I'll talk about more as we go, I think the easiest way to think of it would be intuition. You can trust your intuition. So rather than authority or reason, this makes me think of a line I found from Audre Lorde. She said, You cannot use someone else's fire. You can only use your own. And in order to do so, you have to be willing to believe that you have it. So this is a very consistent element of the teachings of early Buddhism. It's a radical placing authority into the hands of the people who are being taught. Saying, work out your own liberation. The last teaching of the Buddha, work out your own liberation with diligence. Or from the Dhammapada, all the effort must be made by you. Buddhas only show the way. So there's this attempt to not allow the Buddha allow himself to be turned into this ultimate authority. I think he failed, but that's okay. It's not his fault. It's mine. So anyway, he starts with this, empowerment and trust. And then, what is he saying you should trust? And this is where he uses a little judo, I think. Because he actually points them towards what they should be trusting. He says, you can trust yourself. But he's like, maybe you should trust this part. where he says, after he goes through all these things that should not be considered the ultimate authority, he says, when you know for yourselves, these things are unwholesome, these things are blamable, these things are censured by the wise, these things, if undertaken in practice, lead to harm and suffering, then you should abandon them. So at this point, he actually made a shift, because the people who are coming around and have a lot of ideas are like, they're saying the universe is made of matter, the universe is not made of matter, the universe began 6,000 years ago, not that exact one, but something like that, or the universe started with a Big Bang, or whatever it is. They've all got a lot of ideas. And he's like, I'm not talking about metaphysics. He immediately shifts to one question: what are you doing? And he doesn't say, I'm going to talk about what you should be doing. He just says, trust yourself about what you should be doing. If you know something is harmful, abandon doing it. If you know something, that wise people would say, that doesn't help, abandon it. Now, this is weird, because he just said, don't trust all the wise people. And then he said, if you know that wise people wouldn't do this, you should abandon it. So that's a little confusing. This is a similar to a line in the Metta Sutra that says, one who is skilled in goodness should not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Should not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Now, some people say, this sounds really shaming to me. I don't want the people reproving me. But I actually think the import of this is it sneaks in your own wisdom. So if you think, what would a wise person do? Who is the wise person who is being consulted? Who is the wise person who is being consulted? An old trick from the world of recovery from addiction I know is when you're trying to figure out what to do, just imagine like the child that you love the most, and imagine them grown up, and then ask yourself what you would want them to do in this situation. Why does this work? Because what wisdom is love. When you love someone, you have a sense of what would be good to do. So, anyway, Buddha dodges out of any questions of metaphysics and comes to the issue that is the central issue throughout early Buddhist thought, which is how to figure out how to act in a way that's beneficial, how to do your life in a way that's liberative, to spend as little time as you can thinking about manipulating external objects, figuring out unknowable questions, and just figure out what can you do that would be liberative from suffering. So I'll read a little bit more here. What do you think, Kalamas, said the Buddha, when greed, hatred, and delusion arise in a person, is it for his welfare or harm? For his harm, venerable sir, the Kalamas said. Kalamas, a person who is greedy, hating, and deluded, overpowered by greed, hatred, and delusion, his thoughts controlled by them, will destroy life, take what is not given, engage in sexual misconduct, and tell lies. He will also prompt others to do likewise. Will that conduce to his harm and suffering for a long time? Yes, venerable sir. So now the thing is, you could find people, if you ask them those questions, would be like, I don't think so. Like, I made this mistake once when I was teaching meditation at a halfway house. I just said, as I normally would, you know, punching people in the face doesn't really help things. And a bunch of the guys said, yes, it does. Yes, it does. And I was like, oh. So the thing is, by reading this passage, what you can see is the Buddha has a sense that the people he's talking to already have some sense that greed does not promote their welfare, that hatred does not promote welfare. There are people in this world who think hatred promotes people's welfare, right? So this would not be an effective teaching for those people. And I will say, you can find other similar passages where the Buddha, when he encounters someone, they go, well, I don't know, my hate's pretty good. Then he'll go, well, let's talk about what it's like to hate people. And he'll continue to question. But what he'll generally be pointing back to is, how do you actually experience this? And what are the real results? And try and help people to realize for themselves what works and what doesn't for the overall happiness. So So then he goes on, "What do you think, Columbus? Are these things wholesome or unwholesome?" "Unwholesome, venerable sir." "Blamable or blameless?" "Blamable, venerable sir." "Censured or practiced by the wise?" "Censured, venerable sir." "Undertaken and practiced, do they lead to harm and suffering or not?" And they said, "Undertaking and practice these lead to harm and suffering." I'm sure this conversation went exactly like this. So I don't know if you can see, like, the phrases are pulled out and made into a little formula, which is effective for memorization and does not create an air of literary verisimilitude, but that's okay. So this reminds me of a similar case. For some reason today I seem to be talking a lot about addiction recovery. Oh, well. That's how I got into spiritual practice. So the last time I went to rehab, I got out and we had aftercare. And so every week you go back and you check in with your counselor and you sit in a circle and you talk about what's going on. And this dude said, "Yeah, you know, I'm not sure if I'm doing the right thing. You know, last night I went out and I went to a strip club and I ordered a non-alcoholic beer and I just sat there by myself for a while. I'm not sure if that was a good idea." And the counselor was like, "You're not sure if that was a good idea? Are you really going to try and get us to tell you something about that you don't know?" How often could we just pause and go, "Really?" I will give you a piece of advice. When you're about to send that email when you're angry, consider. Consider. When things with someone you love have gotten so heated that it just, everything feels wrong, only thing that will resolve it is them coming around to your point of view? Consider. When you're so sure that you are doing everything wrong and something is fundamentally flawed about you, pause. Consider. What can you do? What can you do? So, as is characteristic of the polycanon, you always get the negative side first and then the positive. It's amazing. You always say, "This is the bad stuff and this is the good stuff." Almost every single time. Thousands of texts. So here we go. Unfortunately, we'll see. Not that unfortunate. So anyway, Buddha goes on, "Come, Columbus. Do not go by oral tradition, by lineage of teaching, by hearsay, by a collection of texts, by logic, by inferential reasoning, by reasoned cogitation, by the acceptance of a view after pondering it, by the seeming competence of a speaker, or because you think this ascetic is our teacher, but when you know for yourselves." So then he goes on, "What do you think, Columbus? When non-greed, non-hatred, and non-delusion arise in a person, is it for their welfare or harm?" "Oh, for his welfare, venerable sir," said the Columbus. "Columbus, a person who is without greed, without hatred, without delusion, not overpowered by greed, hatred, and delusion, thoughts with thoughts not controlled by them, will abstain from the destruction of life, from taking what is not given, from sexual misconduct, and from false speech. He will also prompt others to do likewise. Will that conduce to their welfare and happiness for a long time?" "Yes, venerable sir." So, non-greed, non-hatred, non-delusion. So, the funny thing about early Buddhism, they never say nice stuff like love everybody, or, you know, it's always this letting go of the harmful things is the emphasis. And there are a variety of reasons, but one is that once we start to get the idea of some good thing, we want to go grab it. So by saying non-greed, instead of being like, "Oh, I'm going to get not greedy," we just go, "Oh, I'm going to let go of that thing." So non-greed, all these things, I would say, have their root in the fundamental Indian concept of non-violence or ahimsa. Once you're greedy, you're harming You're taking something from someone. Hatred, harmful, delusion, is to be alienated from other people. This is the delusion of Buddhism, that we are alienated and separate. It's the delusion that allows us to continue to be greedy. It's the delusion that allows us to not feel greedy, but still do things that are harmful to people. It's the delusion is the fundamental concept on which American economy can exist. Because we have to believe that somehow we can keep extracting things from the world and extracting things from countries far across the world, and it's fine, no big deal. It's a delusion of alienation, because we don't realize that we're connected to the way the weather works and the way other people's lives work. So throughout this, although the Buddha is using a fairly logical pattern of reasoning, he's doing it, I think, in a minimally intellectual way. Well, the Kalamas present the problem of all these people who are giving these theories and having read a lot of other texts. I know a lot of the theories are very intellectual and metaphysical, complicated. And he's just like, if you act with this kind of feeling, does it help you or not? He brings it, what he's talking about is how your feelings impel the way you think and how that impels the way you act. Gandhi once said, nonviolence, which is a quality of the heart, cannot come by an appeal to the brain. Nonviolence, which is a quality of the heart, cannot come by an appeal to the brain. I actually think that using the mind can help. And this is actually a fundamental teaching of Buddhist thought, particularly the school which I'm most fond, the Yogacara school, which says that there are two paths or two things we have to work with, our emotional conditioning and our cognitive conditioning. And both of those, really, in tandem, I think, are the most beneficial. But here, Gandhi and Buddha both take the approach that the most powerful and direct road to promoting nonviolence is through just the heart. What are the feelings that impel your behavior? Pay attention to those. So there's a little more of this text, but I think I may not read it, probably. I know you're all saying, more Pali Canon! More! So, you know, underlying all of this is like this question of authority. You know, all these people trying to be authoritative. And, you know, there was a big thing at Buddha's time was that, like, if it was in the Vedic text, that was the ultimate truth. That's similar to someone who might believe, like, everything the Buddha said is the ultimate truth, which would be kind of funny given the text we just read. Or, you know, someone who reads the Bible and says this, everything in this is absolute truth. And it's pretty clear that this is not an approach to understanding truth that the Buddha is promoting. But, you know, it's hard. This is actually pretty hard to figure out. I can say that. Who do you trust? Do you just go to the little chart online that says which news source is least biased? So information is important. Promoting accurate flow of information for everyone is really important. But in terms of Buddhist practice, at the bottom, what's most important is figuring out what is the best thing for you to do and finding the energy and the support to do it. Every time. Every time. So the challenging and the playing with authority, textual authority, is a big part of the Buddhist tradition. It goes on and on and unfolds and unfolds. Anybody who studied, like, the greatest, I think everyone pretty much would agree, most people would agree, the greatest philosopher of Buddhism ever was Nagarjuna. And basically, he just makes a methodology that dissolves every possible way of saying something is ultimately true. And this is just to free us from the tendency to go, I've got the ultimate truth. Now I'm going to get everyone to go the right way. Which doesn't work out for everyone that well. And Zen tends to play with this more. So I'll read you a little story. It's case 76 from... Actually, I'm not sure which book it is. Oh, well. Okay, so this is an old koan. Hogen, a Chinese Zen teacher, lived alone in a small temple in the country. One day, four traveling monks appeared and asked if they might make a fire in his yard to warm themselves. While they were building the fire, Hogen heard them arguing about subjectivity and objectivity. Ooh, that sounds fancy. He joined them and said, "There is a big stone. Do you consider it to be inside or outside of your mind?" One of the monks replied, "From the Buddhist viewpoint, everything is an objectification of mind. So I would say that the stone is inside my mind." "Your head must feel very heavy if you are carrying around a stone like that in your mind." So Zen, in particular, many Zen stories are about kind of poking fun at highly developed Indian streams of logic. At the same time, they often take them up and are deeply informed by them. So I would say the characteristic here is not so much that, although this monk's expression of mind only is profoundly inaccurate, not to say that whatever teachings it was coming from were wrong, but to just keep playing with it, to play with it. The Buddha is not very playful in this text, I'll admit it. He's not a very playful teacher. Zen brings this element of play. And I know Wanda and Tim have been talking quite a bit about the playfulness that comes into Buddhism through the Taoist tradition. But we don't have to go get it from the Taoist tradition, everybody. You can just go get it right here. You can get it right here. Friends, does it conduce to your welfare to be playful? Yes. Venerable sir, come on. All right. So, the Kalama Sutra is beloved by people from the kind of tradition that I'm from, which is a Western intellectual tradition that questions authority, that didn't get into Zen because we were trying to get a religion that would give us a whole bunch of beliefs that we could just say, "Now I have it." Right? I didn't want that. I don't know, maybe you do, and that's okay if you do. But a lot of people come to this tradition because they're interested in some of the things that a religious tradition can offer, but blind belief is really not one of them. So the Kalama Sutra, although it's like one millionth of the Pali Canon, this is the second talk we've had on it. I think Ted was saying he gave one a few years ago. So we love this. It's cool. It affirms what we already believe. Uh-oh. Back to square one. But I will say, are you guys getting like all kinds of weird noises in there? Is there a, well, bless you, oh technological wizards. Yes.
Maybe when you move your hands close to the microphone, you might be doing that.
Okay, cool. That'll be good. Thank you. Anyway, proceeding. Here's the thing. The Buddha by no means consistently just said, "You figure it out." There are countless texts where people go, "Hey, could you explain this?" And he's like, "Oh, yeah." So there's a lot of instruction, and many of his teachings are very challenging to, I think, almost any listener and certainly the people to whom he's presenting them. So, with the Kalamas, I think it's important to see the context. These are people who are like, all these different people come by and say all this stuff. And he's like, is it going to help them for me to be just one more person who does the same thing that they're already confused about? Say, I've got it. So he finds a way to communicate with these people that's based in trusting them, in trusting their hearts and empowering them. But in many, many cases, and I would say the majority of cases, where either students come to him for advice or people who are authoritative, often Brahmins, who are like kind of the high caste people, would come in and like debate him. And he's very willing to just be like, all right. Although usually his mode of debate is to demonstrate, allow that person to demonstrate his view by questioning them. Anyway, I like to read you some things that might be challenging. Why not? So there's a whole category of sutras called the gratification, danger, and escape. I'll just read you the first paragraph of one. By the way, this he will refer to himself as a bodhisattva. This is a fun thing for all you people who hang out here. In the earliest text, bodhisattva just meant the original Buddha before he was enlightened. So there wasn't this idea of lots of bodhisattvas or you can become a bodhisattva. It's just like that was the state of being in preparation to be Buddha. I don't know. Prepare? Why not? Just do it now. Anyway, before my enlightenment, O monks, while I was still a bodhisattva, it occurred to me, what is the gratification in things? What is the danger in things? And what is the escape from things? Then it occurred to me, whatever pleasure and joy there is in things, this is the gratification in them. That things are impermanent, bound up with suffering, and subject to change, this is the danger in things. The removal and abandoning of desire and lust for things, this is the escape from things. Well, I don't know about you, but I am really habituated to trying to get things that I like. I mean, like, I got up this morning and I like to have my alarm stock yelling at me. Right? That was like, within 2 seconds of being awake, I was like, desire. And then I'm like, ooh, I desire coffee. Yes. And then it was like, I desire toast. And then, I desire a nice, pleasant word with my spouse. That's all nice, right? But ding, ding. I mean, like, if you look at your consciousness, you'll see that it is like, I want this, I want that, I want this, I want that. Beep, beep, beep. And it may be, you know, sometimes really intense. You know, we're just like, oh, it's raw, we're consumed. And sometimes it's subtle, but it's just happening. And I think, you know, it would be like, well, but shouldn't I desire things? I want people to be well. I want to have a world that's more equitable and where people aren't suffering so much and where I'm not suffering so much. And this teaching that I just read challenges that view. But it challenges it radically, because what he's pointing towards is not caring about what happens in the world, but he's coming back to the same point that he did in the Kalama Sutra. What are you doing? And he's saying, instead of thinking, I'm going to do this so I can get that, he's just saying, just do it. Because it's good. And be free of the profound frustration of the fact that the world keeps doing stuff that is not agreeing with you. So, this is an invitation to be freed from waiting for something else to happen and to be freed into your own power. That you can do something liberative moment after moment. And that the more you do that based on not an idea of wanting something else and not based on trying to get rid of something, and most importantly perhaps for us, not based in an idea that we are separate from anything, then what happens is the energy of our lives flows out in nonviolent action. And this happens. You just notice it. You notice it with people you love, where you might just have that moment where you're just, you know, not worrying about whether they're going to like what you do or not. You just do something kind. This can be freeing. In that moment where you're marching down the street in a sea of pink hats, and you're like, yeah, I don't think we're probably going to end patriarchy today. You know, you're not like, are we going to get this done today? You're just like, I'm here, and we're together. So Buddha presents a variety of teachings that meet people where they are. And he challenges people, and it's good to be challenged. And he challenges people who trust him. So when someone comes to you for advice, they're showing trust. The Kalamas, he's like, I'm not going to make you trust me. You should trust me. Ah, no. When people enter into a mutual relationship of trust, there's room for them to challenge each other. I think of a story where, I sewed my robe for ordination, and I'm not naturally good at sewing, and I don't particularly naturally like it. It took me like a year of sewing a few hours a week. And I sewed under the, I'm very grateful to have sewed under the instruction of Tomoe Katagiri, who was one of the founders of this place. And she was a great teacher. She's very quiet. She doesn't say much. And she models just doing the thing you're doing with your whole heart and not waiting for a result. She models it beautifully. So anyway, when sewing this thing, you know, it's a long time. And once you get done sewing it, you have to iron it really carefully in a very specific way so it will hold together correctly. The taking care of fabric is like it's a Japanese cultural thing, but it's also it's just part of what we do around here. So anyway, I'm like sewing for ever and ever. And it was hard for me. I tried not to complain or anything, but it was hard. And I got done, and I was like, you know, I'm sitting in Tomoe's basement. And I was so happy to be done. You know, like I did the thing and now I have the thing. I desired the thing and I have the thing. And I said, Tomoe, I finished. And she said, oh, I'll go turn the iron on. She challenged me. She gave me no time to make my life about getting something and invited me to just do the next thing under her loving tutelage. But remembering trust can also help us in these fraught times when there's so many painful conversations and such a sense of rift. I have found that finding ways to create an atmosphere of trust enables for conversation which can be transformative. Thank you. Well, we have a few minutes here for other voices to manifest in the form of question, comment, poetry. Yes. Please use your voice.
Could you please repeat the quote about not using another person's fire?
Yeah. Request for the repetition of the quote by Audre Lorde. You cannot use someone else's fire. You can only use your own. And in order to do that, you must first be willing to believe that you have it. And, if you look Audre Lorde and use another's fire, you can find that one. Or I'll write it down for you, or I'll email it to you. It's good.
So, I would like to recommend a movie that really, for me personally, demonstrated this quote beautifully. It was the movie Wonder Woman. Some of you may have already seen this. Some of you maybe have not. But just for me personally, I can't think of a better modern story that really demonstrates the things that we just went through today. And that movie, if you haven't seen it, it's actually the Greek mythology is kind of the underlying themes in terms of beliefs and values and such, but it just really beautifully had the main character really believing that she had her own fire and not letting anyone dissuade her from moving forward with what she really believed was the right thing to do.
Thank you.
I'm amazed at how applicable this is today.
Can you guys hear? Okay.
But I just think it's so interesting that it's so able to be applied to today, as you say, some of the issues. I've worked on climate change for 10 years, and you know, when I first started, the idea was that if we just give people facts, and what's happening with climate change, then they'll get it, and they'll want to work on this. And what we realized is that then it just became this, like, really contentious, every fact was, you know, a counterfact. And not surprisingly, a couple of years at the Genoa Yale climate studies is that you can't convince people based on fact alone, that you have to really connect with them at the heart. And so the really now the transition and, you know, the work that we've been doing the last couple of years is very much so meeting people where they're at, not arguing with them on their point, helping them you know, just share your values, find the value that you share, and then be able to, you know, just share your own kind of story so that it's not, because people can argue fast, but they can't argue your personal story.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very much everything you talked about today, which is very much connecting with people and not trying to just counter other people's arguments, but connecting a lot of people. So I just think it's very applicable. I just want to thank you for today.
Thank you.
Hey, there's sort of a thing in Christianity that I thought of. I don't know if there's an equivalent Buddhist saying, but in Matthew there's a quote that goes something like, "Cast the beam from thine own eye before you cast the mote from your neighbor's." So he's saying that there is something blind in you, and not to criticize and to judge others before you yourself are whole. And I don't know.
It's good stuff. Well, I'll give you one from the Dhammapada. There are a couple that are very similar. This one's pretty good, though. It is easy to see the faults of others. We winnow them like chaff. It is hard to see our own. We hide them as a gambler hides a losing draw.
I wish that learning to trust yourself was as easy as saying, "I'm going to trust myself." Because you could be sitting around and going, "Okay, this is good. I'm going to learn to trust myself now." The part of you that does that looks up at you and goes, "What?" And I can't say how grateful I am for our meditation practice, because I feel like I've learned how to do it this much.
Mm-hmm.
And that so much of that has just been from being willing to be patient and listen for it.
Mm-hmm.
And then maybe it will say something once you know, once it knows that you're actually interested in it. But it's really hard.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah. It's good to do, though. But yes, I know. I forget all the time.
So I went to see the cardboard piano at Parkscore Theater, which I highly recommend. But while the board has a bunch of post-it notes, I was asking for comments on forgiveness. The one I liked the best was, "Holding a grudge is like drinking poison and expecting the other person to die."
Holding a grudge is like drinking poison and expecting the other person to die. Yeah. But we have pain. So we, how do we not hold it? That's our practice, is one of not holding on to our pain, but opening up to it. So the patterns of our mind and our body and our emotional life create a holding. And our practice allows for that to be aerated and for us to open up, or as Uchiyama Roshi says, open the hand of thought. But our pain is real and it's important. When I was at this event called Race, Love, and Liberation that was led by Reverend Angel Kyoto Williams. And one of the most moving parts of the whole experience was right at the very end. We were just, people were sharing who had been through the retreat. And there was a woman talking, and she was an African-American woman. I think she had a long time connection to activism from what I heard from her. And she said, you know, I just want to be with the universe. You know what I mean? I don't want to feel separate and alienated. And she said, and I'm angry, and I've been thinking I got to get rid of this anger so I can be more effective. And she's like, but I'm realizing, like, this has to happen from the heart. Does this sound like what Gandhi said? This has to happen from the heart. And she said, I'm realizing that what anger can do is it can allow me to move from my head into my heart. So pain, difficult emotional states, are an invitation to come here and be with this part of our reality. Not hold on to it, not try and cultivate it or polish it, but just be real with it. And let that deepen our compassion. We start with compassion for our own emotional life. And that is the way forward. Thank you.